And we're holding Chaf Vav Amud Aleph, the fourth line. The Mishnah had listed a number of people who are posel eders, and all of them are posel to judge as well. The Rashi and Tosfos had discussed on the Mishnah actually whether Rashi had said that all we're listing over here is people who are posel d'rabbanan. And Tosfos had said maybe not necessarily, maybe some of them are posel d'oraisa as well. Anyway, basically the idea is, oh, the ones listed in the Mishnah, and then there was a Braisa that had added a couple of others, are all people who are posel because of one or another Aveda that they do. So the Mishnah had mentioned Soichrei Shviyas, people who are doing business with Shmita fruit. And we said then Rabbi Yehuda had said Rabbi Shimon had said in the Mishnah that originally they used to call them Oisfei Shviyas, people who gather Shmita, and then they started calling them Soichrei Shviyas, meaning people who do business with Shmita fruit. So what does all that mean? So Amar Rav Shimon Betchilah Hayukoronos and Oisver Shvius. My comma. What does Rav Shimon mean by that? Amar Rav Yehuda Hachi comma. So Rav Yehuda explains like this. Betchilah Hayuomrim. Originally, the Chachamim used to say Oisver Shvius Ksherin. People who gather Shmita fruit are kosher to give Eders. Because after all, I mean, doing Shmita, the produce is hefker. So the Oisver Shvius are people who are gathering for themselves. So they're kosher. They're not doing anything wrong. But people who are merchants, people who go and collect a lot of Shmita fruit and then they go and sell it, then even though the Oisver might also, the Yad Ramah points out, the Oisver might also be gathering more than they need for their family's use. Nevertheless, the Chachamim didn't find a reason to begin with to passel them because of that. It's true they're only supposed to be collecting a certain amount, but nevertheless, at least they're not doing business with it. The Torah says you're not allowed to do La'ochla, from which we learn, V'loy L'schoda, you're not allowed to sell it. So as long as they're not selling, then they figured that the ones who are just gathering a lot are not possible. But then you started having a lot of people who were giving money to the aniyim in order to that the poor people should go and collect a lot of fruit and give it to them. So therefore, in effect, they are doing schorah with it. They're advancing money. They're laying out money to the poor people and telling them, you go and collect X amount to pay the shvius and bring it to us. So that amounts to selling it. So then they started saying that both groups are posel eders. So in short, in other words, what Rashi means, so in other words, what Rav Shimon means is that originally they said that the ones who are now posel, they called them Oisvei Shvius, they said they were only gathering, so therefore it's kosher, and then they realized that no, there's this thing going on behind the scenes where they're actually doing it because of the money that the rich people are paying them, and therefore they started calling them Soichrei Shvius and said that they're posel eders. Well, Koshubobne Rachva. The sons of Rachva had a problem with that explanation. We find Rachva in a number of places in Shas. He was a Talmud of Rabbi Yehuda. Actually, we had at the end of the first parak, the Gemara had given a listing over there of Harifei de Pumpadissa. The Gemara had given a listing over there of a variety of names and nicknames that we have throughout Shas of different people, or different groups of people. One of them was, we said, Harifei de Pumpadissa. We said Harifei de Pumpadissa, or the sharp ones of Pumpadissa. We said are the sons of Rachva. Whose names were Epha and Avimi. So now they ask the following question on what Rabbi Yehuda is saying. Hai Misha Rabu Ha'anosim. So what does it mean then? Though the fact is, the Mishnah had said that the Mishnah had said once the Anosim proliferated, then they said Echadzeh. Anosim means people who are forcing other people to do something. Now these rich people are not forcing the poor people to take the money and collect the produce for them. It should say when the merchants proliferated. Because that's what it is. These people are trying to be merchants. They want to be able to sell Peter Shvius and make a profit on it. And therefore they're laying out money and having the poor people be their cat's paw to collect them. So Ella, no, the sons of Rachva explain, on the contrary, what the Mishnah means is originally they were saying that both groups are posel. But then, whether they're collecting a lot, not for their families, but rather they're collecting more than that. But whether to begin with they're actually collecting in order to do business with it. Either way, they said that they're puzzled. Misharabu anosim, but once anosim started proliferating, umay ninhu, and what are anosim means anoina, people who are government ministers who are coming around to collect anoina, which is a type of tax. In particular, Rashi explains anoina is tax on produce. You grew X amount of produce, therefore you have to give X amount of it as a certain amount of kurim of it to the government as taxes. So now the problem was actually that they weren't just saying, in that case, fine, I understand this year you didn't have a crop, therefore because it's your Shemitah, therefore you don't have to pay these taxes. On the contrary, they would say, we want those taxes, we want that anona, no matter what. You didn't grow anything this year, tough luck, you still have to pay it anyway. So that was a problem. That was a matter of pikuach nefesh for people, because they could be thrown in jail or worse if they don't pay that anona. So therefore, we find an example where Rabbi Yanai made an announcement. He told the Jewish farmers, "Puku v'ziru v'shvius mishum arnoina, go and plant in Shvius because of arnoina, because of this problem of that the Romans are demanding the taxes, and you have to pay it no matter what. So therefore, you have no choice." Now, there is a lot of explanation. There is a lot of discussion. Tosfos opens the discussion. Wait a minute. The fact is, we're talking about Issur D'oraisa over here. How is he allowing them that? Now, well, if it was actual Pikuach Nefesh, then fine, it wouldn't really be a question. But I guess the point is, it's not so much Pikuach Nefesh. It's more they might be subject to high fines or other things like that. So Tosfos answers, there's two possibilities. First of all, the second answer is it was Pikuach Nefesh, because you know they're being demanded taxes and they don't have, and they end up getting arrested and dying in jail. However, Tosfos's first answer is that nowadays Shmittah is only Drabbanan, because Shmittah would apply Jaraisa only when most or all of the Jewish people are living in Eretz Yisrael in their respective territories of their Shvatim, and by Rabbi Yana's times that wasn't the case anymore. It was after Churban Bayis. It was 150-200 years after Churban Bayis. And I don't know if most of the Jews still. So I don't know if most of the Jews were still living in Eretz Yisrael, but in any case, they certainly weren't. They certainly weren't living in their defined territories. Yovel, in particular, wasn't in effect. And when Yovel is not in effect, then Shemitah is not in effect d'oraisa either. So for either of these reasons, he could allow it. He was allowing it. There was an interesting thing that some historians say. Why Dafke in Rabbi Yana's times did this come up? Historically, there was one of the many wars between the Romans and the Persians that was being then, and the year in which it was being fought. It was in the early 3rd century, 215, 216 or something like that, happened to be a Shemitah year. So the Romans demanded extra arnona to feed their armies. And since it was a Shemitah year, then Rabbi Yana is telling people, yeah, we don't really have much of a choice but to do with that. So once that kind of thing happened, Chozru Loima, then the Chachamim had to say, Oisfin Kshirin Sirchin Psulin. People who gather a larger amount of produce than are kosher l'eders, only the ones who are actually doing business with it and buying and selling it, would be possible. Now the Rabban points out another point as well, don't we? What happened when Goyim are forcing Jews to violate mitzvahs? Then when it's a shas hashmad, then we say Yehorig Val Yaver on any mitzvah, as we're going to have later in the Masechta. And the Rabban answers, because here you could arguably the king is doing it for his hana. Fine, it may well be he's not doing it out of any particular love for the Jews, but officially at least he's doing it in order to supply his army and whatever. And therefore, so it's not the kind of thing you would only have Yehorig Val Yaver on the big three, and Shmittah is not one of them. So now the Gemara tells a story in this connection about people working during Shmittah, where there may have been a matter of Arnona, where there's a matter of Arnona involved, where they're doing it in order to pay their taxes. So the Gemara tells Rabbi Chiya bar Zamnuki, Rabbi Shimon ben Yehud Tzadok, Havu Ka'azli v'Abba Shana v'Asya. Rabbi Chiya bar Zamnuki and Rabbi Shimon ben Yehud Tzadok are going to declare an Ibur Yor in Esya. Asir. Asir, whatever, is a, in English, you have the name Asia Minor, which is nowadays basically Turkey. So they were going there in order to make a leap year. Now, Tosfos points out, we learned in the first perek of Our Masechta that you're not supposed to declare a leap year outside Eretz Yisrael. So first of all, Tosfos says that, since the continuation of the story is, what it is they're not going there to declare the actual leap year, they're going there to make the calculations for it. As we learned in the first paragraph, the calculations to determine whether you need a leap year this year sometimes can be pretty intricate. And not always did they have the menuchas hanefesh to do it, the peace of mind to do it in Eretz Yisrael, what with the Romans being always on top of them. Asia Minor, to be sure, is part of the Roman Empire as well, but since I guess the Jewish communities there weren't as large and they were a little bit out of the way, then maybe the Romans didn't care so much if a couple of the Chachamim are coming over there. So they found it a safer place. We find in various times during those centuries, we find different times when Asia was considered to be a safer place than Eretz Yisrael. So here these Chachamim are going there to do that. Other Mephoshim talk about possibilities that maybe even they could declare the actual leap year over there as well. Maybe in fact, I mean, even though Rabbi Yochanan is still there in Eretz Yisrael, and the Gemara elsewhere says that you can only do that in Chutz Laaretz, only if there's nobody of your caliber left in Eretz Yisrael. But here and here, Rish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan are still in Eretz Yisrael, as we're going to see further on in the story. Maybe the vort is that they are the greatest experts in Ibra Shana, in these calculations, and maybe therefore they're able to do it in Chutz Laaretz. Tosfos, by the way, also points out, we have to say that they're not actually declaring the leap year because it was Shmita year, as we're going to have in the story over here, and as we learned in the first parak, you don't make a leap year during a Shmita year. However, Mephoshim say, listen, on the other hand, you know, as we learned then, the Rambam holds that you could do it during the Shmita year when you're doing it because of the tekufa, or because the grain is not ripe yet. It's only when you have the other considerations that we learned about there that you're supposed to not do it during Shmita. So therefore, the fact that it was a Shmita doesn't necessarily mean they're not making an actual leap year. Okay, in any case, whether they're going to make the calculations, whether they're going to declare the leap year, whatever, Pogubahu Rish Lakish. Rish Lakish met up with them on the way. Omar, he joined up together with them. He decided to go with them. Omar, he figures to himself, Ezel Echsi Hechi Abdi Uvda. I want to go and see how they do it. He himself is not one of the experts who are going to make these calculations, but he wants to learn Torah and see how exactly they do it. As they're walking along, Chazulahu Gavra de Kokoriv, Rish Lakish saw a certain person plowing his field. And it's Shemitah here, you're not supposed to. Omalahen, so Rish Lakish says to the other Chachamim, Koyin v'chodesh, how could this be? This guy's a Koyin. I recognize that he's a Koyin, And later on, the Gemara is going to look, and he's plowing during Shemitah. Rashi points out, the Gemara is going to point out further down the Omud, after we go through the story, that Koyanim particularly are suspect of violating Shemitah, as we'll get to soon in the Gemara. So therefore he's saying, look at this guy, he's plowing, he's a Yid, he's plowing during Shemitah, he must be a Koyan, and he's being over on the Averis, and he's being over on the Sodom of Shemitah. So you should tell him off for that, he's doing something wrong. So Reb Chiya and Reb Shimon say, no, Yochaloy ma agistan ani v'soichay. This guy can say, I'm only an agistan in the field, which means a socher, a hired laborer. It's land that belongs to a goy. It's a land that belongs to a goy, and I'm only a hired laborer who's working in it. Or it's a matter of this arnona that we said before, that therefore the owner of the field himself may be a yid, and he has the right to have it, he has the permission of the chachamim in a case like this to work at doing shmita because of arnona. So we're not going to say anything to him. I forgot to mention, by the way, when we were just talking about this matter of Arnona and that people were being forced to violate Shemitah because of it, you find a number of times earlier than that in Jewish history where it's particularly mentioned. Josephus, for example, mentions it sometimes in his history, particular times when foreign kings conquered Eretz Yisrael, and one of the ways in which they showed how good they were to Jews is by exempting them from taxes during Shemitah. He tells it about Alexander the Great. He tells it about when the Seleucids of Syria first conquered Eretz Yisrael a few decades before the story of Hanukkah, different other examples like that where they were made to understand that, listen, we Jews have our Shemitah, and therefore there's going to be a year when there's no produce and therefore no taxes, and they would go along with that, as opposed to over here we're saying the Romans were not. In any case, so Reb Chiya and Reb Shimon are saying to Reb Shlokish, that's the situation over here. Either this land belongs to a guy, or it belongs to a yid who's having to work it because he has to pay his anona taxes, and therefore this yid is not necessarily doing anything wrong, and we're not going to go and give him musa for it. Okay, I mean, there's discussion about it among Mefarshim, because this point about that, you know, Rashi's first explanation, that he's working for a goy, is not so simple anyway. You're not supposed to do that during Shemitah. Just because the owner of the field is a goy doesn't give you a heter to work it during Shemitah. Tosfos prefers Rashi's second explanation, and then Tosfos Rosh and the Meiri give several other answers of how it was working out, how it could be valid Alfi Torah. Okay. Next, Chu Chazilau Hu Gavra. Then Reb Shlokish saw another guy to have a kosach bekarmi. He was pruning in the vineyards. So he's going around in the vineyards and pruning off the dead branches, which is also something that you're not allowed to do during Shemitah. On the other hand, and again, Reb Shlokish says to them, Koyin v'zomer. He's a koyin apparently, and he's pruning the vines. What's going on over here? Omruloi, again, Reb Chiya and Reb Shimon tell him, Yochel Loimar. This guy would be able to say, if you asked him why he's pruning branches off the vines, he could say, I'm not doing it in order to improve the vines, I'm doing it because I need branches for an eko beis habad. Now it's like this. A beis habad is an olive press. When you have a pile of olives over there and you're going to press them to produce oil, you need something around them, you need something to hold them in place, otherwise they're going to squirt out in every direction and you're not going to get very much oil. So what you do is there's different ways. We learned in Bava Basra, one way of doing it, you might have what are called dapim, you might have boards that you put around them to hold them in place. But another way would be you'd put an akel, kind of like a netting around them. You'd weave branches together to make like a netting, and then you'd tie that tightly around the olives, and then you bring the beam down on them to crush them. So this guy can say that I'm pruning these branches for Eko Beis Habad. Now Tosfos points out the fact is if he's improving the grapevine, it would still be osur as well. What we're talking about is we have to say that he's doing it in a way that's not helping the grapevine. So let's say he's not cutting off dead branches, which is true, that would be improving the vine. We have to say, for example, that he's cutting off fresh branches or something, or he's doing it all on one side or whatever it is that it would be mutter. Maybe there are some other Rishonim who learn differently. There's an explanation within the Rambam that maybe it would be mutter as long as he doesn't have that intention. Marsha also has a bit of a lengthy explanation of this Tosfos over here discussing the ins and outs of what exactly would be mutter and what would be osur as well. Marshal talks about it and compares it to dinim of Shabbos, when it would be considered the malacha of koitzer and when it would be considered the malacha of neteya because he's promoting the growth versus one versus the other. And Marshal talks about the ins and outs of that. So the point is, so again, they're making an excuse for the guy and saying that he's not doing it in order to work the land, which is also doing Shemitah, but rather because he needs it for that kind of purpose. Omalahem, so the Shlokish answers them with a play on words. Halev Yedea, he says, the heart of this person knows, Imla Ekel, Imla Akalkalos, is he taka cutting off those branches to use for an ekel, like you're saying, or is it for akalkalos, which means crookedness? Is he knowingly violating Shemitah? And if you asked him, he would tell you, or maybe even if you didn't ask him, but Hashem knows the truth, and he knows the truth, whether he's actually doing it to violate Shemitah, or whether, as you're claiming, he's doing it for ekel, he's doing it to make a netting for the Beit Habad over there. So he's using a play on words, Ekel and Akalkalos. An interesting point over here in Hilchos Lashon Hara, the Chafetz Chaim points out, you know, what happened to Don Lakaf's host, and the answer is, when you have a strong reason to say that it's much more likely that what he's doing is wrong, and it would be only a very rare case where what he's doing is right, then you're entitled to hold of him negatively, and that's what the Shlokish did. He figures that the likelihood is people are cutting off branches off grapevines. Generally, they're doing it in order to improve the grapevine, which is something that's also doing Shemitah. Yeah, you could say that maybe he's doing it for this Eichel, but come on, he says. Okay. Well, the Gemara interjects. The Gemara interjects into the story, Hey Omalahu Bereisha. Which of these things happened first? Which one did he talk to them first? Ilema Hokamaisa Omalahu Bereisha. Was it in the order in which we said over here that first he saw the guy plowing, and afterwards he saw another person, pruning his vines? Well, why do they need a new excuse as far as an ankle? Honami Lemu Agistan Ani Basarche. Can't they say the same thing? The second guy is probably an Agistan as well. So why do they need to come up with a new idea? He tells them rather what it is. He tells them the stories are told out of order. First they saw the guy pruning his vines, and they told him that it's not even necessarily an issue because he's using it for an echo base abad. And then he told them the first one that we listed first, the one about the guy plowing, and then they tell him he might be an agistin. Okay. So the Gemara says, "My shna koyin." Why, in both cases, did Rish Lakish mention the point that the guy is a koyin? And the reason is mishum dechashidi ashvius. Koyanim, in particular, are suspect about shmita, that they're suspect of violating the dinim of shmita. The Tnan, or the Tanya, actually, it's a Braisa, saw Truma Shinofel Meir Sig Shal Shvius. Suppose that one saw of Truma falls into 100 saw of Peiris Shvius. Now, normally, truma requires 100 times as much in order to be bottle. Usually, you have one saw of truma falls into 100 saw of cholin, then it then becomes bottle. And now, in order not to deprive the kohenim of the one saw, you have to take out a saw from the mixture and give it to them. But the rest of it is mutu lazorim, even though inevitably some of the original truma is going to be mixed in there. But it was bottle. The same way as most isurim, you need 60 times to be bottle. When it comes to shmita, you need 100 times. So it can be brought up, meaning in other words, you can take out one saw to give to the kohenim, and the rest of it remains mutter to you. But if it falls into less than that amount, and then it's called meduma, then it's a mixture, which then usually the rule is that only kohenim can eat it. But in this case, yerokvu, we have to leave the whole thing to rot. It came because the truma wasn't bottle. Now, the Chachamim discussed this point. Amai Yerokvu, why do we have to leave it to rot? There comes a point eventually, the time of beer, the time when a particular kind of produce is not available in the fields anymore, and then you have to take all of what you have left of that out of your house. But up until that point, they ought to be able to eat it. Or the koyanim, that is, should be able to eat it. So you kerenu l'koyin bin mei truma. Why don't you sell it to the koyin at the cheaper price of truma? Now truma always costs less than cholin because there are fewer takers for it. Only koyanim can eat it. They can only eat it when they're tahor. So truma always sells for a lesser price than the equivalent of cholin. So in other words, what we should do is. Now, even though we said before you're not allowed to sell peiros shvius, Rashi points out you are allowed to sell them in a way where the person is going to be eating them before the time of, and using up the money before the time of beer. So that's what you do over here. Figure out how much the saw is worth. You say like this. In other words, I had 90 saw of peiros shvius over here. Now there's one saw of truma mixed in, so now the whole thing is also to me as a zor. Fine, I'm going to figure out how much would 91, not 91, 90 actually, one of them is truma, you can't sell that to the koyan, but how much are 90 saw of grain or whatever it is worth at the value of truma, sell it to a koyan for that amount, make sure that he eats all the 90 saw, and that you, the seller, use up all the money before the time of beer comes. Why don't we do that? Why don't we just leave it to rot?
Why can't you add some non-truma to dilute it to 100?
That's called ein mevatel issur l'chatchila. Once you have an issur mixed in, you're not allowed to be mevatel it by adding more heter. That comes up in the halachas of kashrus, for example. It comes up in a variety of situations. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the question is again, why don't we say, so he should sell the whole thing at the value of truma, bidmei truma, at the value of truma, chutz bidmei oisa saw, except for that one saw. So in other words, again, you say there's 91 here in the mixture, 90 that were there originally, one saw of truma. The one saw of truma, of course, you can't sell to the kohen, it belongs to him in the first place, but you sell him the other 90 at the price that you would usually, that a kohen would usually pay for truma, and make sure that he eats it and that you use up the money before the time of beer. The Amr of Chia Meshmeidu Ula, so Reb Chia tells us in the name of Ula, Zoyse Meres, Nechshedu Koyin Mashvias. We see from this, that Koyinim are suspect about violating the Dinim of Shemitah. Now, why would they do that? Rashi explains, they figure like this. After all, we, unlike Yisraelim, are allowed to eat Truma. And Kodshe Kodshim. So relative to us, those things which are Kodesh and off limits to everybody else are Cholin, not really Cholin, but whatever, we're allowed to eat them where another Yid is not. So therefore they figure it to themselves. Shemitah, the same thing. Why is Shemitah fruit off limits? And why do they have restrictions on it? Because there's Kedusha to it. Well, the same way as we're allowed Truma, which has Kedusha to it, the same way we should be allowed Shemitah, which has a Kedusha to it. And they don't realize, of course, that there's a difference. Therefore, we can't trust the Kohen. In short, we can't trust the Kohen to eat the produce in time, and then therefore we can't sell him this mixture. So now the Shlokish is coming and then generalizing from that. Now that doesn't mean that usually we would suspect Kohenim of actually violating the dinim of agriculture during Shemitah, but the Shlokish is kind of generalizing from here. If you see that there's an example when it comes to dinim of Shemitah where Kohenim find a heter for themselves, they find a rationalization for themselves to be over on it, then maybe the same thing is going on over here as far as these workers, and maybe then whether and therefore they seem to be, Reb Shlokish in effect is saying, I wouldn't suspect a regular Yid of violating the dinim of Shemitah. But maybe since we already see that the Kohenim are lax in the dinim of Shemitah, maybe this too. So that explains what his objection was. Well, now getting back to the story of Reb Shlokish and the other two Chachamim, Am Omru said Reb Chia and Reb Shimon said to the other, Turuduhudain, this guy's a nudnik. He keeps on saying that he thinks he sees these people violating Shemitah, and we know that there could be good reasons why they're doing it. So eventually when they came to there, they came to the place in Essia where they're going to be making their calculations and or declaring a leap year. Slickle the Igra, they went up to the second floor. We found back in the first parak, we find that often the gathering place of the Chachamim when they were deciding whether to make a leap year would be in the second floor of a house, which was like the main living room, the main gathering area in the house, so therefore they were going up to there. Shafur the Dagami Tuse, and they took out the ladder so that Reb Shlokish couldn't come up there with them. So here he had gone all the way with them to Essia, and they won't even let him in because they decided he's a nudnik and we don't really want him around. Also, like Hamedi Reb Yechanan, so Reb Shlokish went back to Reb Yechanan in Eretz Yisrael, Omalei, and he asks him, without mentioning their names, he asks, Bnei Adam Achshudin Al Shvius, when you have people who are suspect of violating Shemitah, because here they're defending people who are on the face of it. The way I see it, you have people, these farmers who were violating Shemitah, and here you have these two Chachamim were defending them, which makes them suspect about Shemitah as well. Why would they be defending such Rishoyim if they themselves are not guilty of such a thing? Ksherin La'aber Shana, are they kosher to declare a leap year? So in other words, in short, he's asking, you know, do Reb Chia and Reb Shimon really have the right to declare a leap year if we have reason to suspect their faithfulness to halacha? Hodur Omar, then Shlokish, after he asks the question, he rethinks it. He says, you know what, loy kashali, in a way, that's not such a question. Midi to have a shloisha roye boker, because at the beginning of the previous perek, the Gemara had given an example where there were three cowherds sitting around and talking about the weather, and the Chachamim, each one of them was saying something. It was on Yud Ches Amud Beis. Each one of them was saying something regarding the weather, that if the weather is such and such, then yes, we can see it's Adar-type weather, and if not, then apparently it's Shvat-type weather, implying, in other words, that this year needs a leap year, and the Chachamim ended up declaring a leap year, and the Gemara had explained over there, it's not really, they're not just relying on what they're overhearing from these cowherds, but Abonan Achush B'nai U'samich, where the Gemara had said over there, the Chachamim, now the Roye Boker themselves, the Gemara has discussed over here on Daf Chafei, that Roye Boker, that cowherd, are often posel la'edus. They may well be posel la'edus, first of all, because they don't know the dinim, but second of all, because they may graze their animals in other people's fields, which is a type of gezel. Nevertheless, over there, the Chachamim are not actually relying on those three cowherds to make a leap year. But Rabbanan, Achush B'nai U'samach, the Chachamim are relying on their calculations. They calculated that this year needs to be a leap year, and in addition, and in fact, that was borne out by the conversation between these three cowherds about the weather. So therefore, so Rish Lakish thinks to himself, you know what, maybe I shouldn't be asking the question. Fine, I mean, listen, the Chachamim here in Eretz Yisrael have decided that there's a good chance we need a leap year. Here, Reb Chiya and Reb Shimon are only going to Essia in order to continue from there, because at this point in Eretz Yisrael, the Romans are making it impossible. So therefore, fine, maybe it's not so bad. At worst, these guys are like Royed Bakker. Then Rish Lakish thinks it over to himself again, and he says, wait a minute, Loi Dami, it's not the same kind of thing. Because the difference is exactly that. There the Chachamim gathered together, and they voted on it, and they declared a leap year. So what happened was, they had thought, to begin with, maybe we need a leap year. They heard these three cowherds talking about the weather, and about how cold it was, compared that it's not normal Adar weather, it's more like Shvat weather. And therefore, the Chachamim then went and gathered together and made a leap year, after all. Ultimately, it was based on their initial calculations, but the point is the Chachamim did eventually get together and do that. Chacha, but over here, Rish Lakish thinks to himself, oh, he's saying all of this to Rabbi Yochanan, Kesher Rishoyim, this seems to be a bond, a conspiracy of Rishoyim. Because again, from his way of thinking, Reb Chiya and Reb Shimon, he's comparing them, he's saying that they're Rishoyim, because he's saying, apparently, they're willing to tolerate people violating Shemitah and making excuses for them. So it's called Kesher Rishoyim. It's called the conspiracy of Rishoyim. The Kesher Rishoyim Einim in Aminyan. And a conspiracy of Rishoyim does not count towards the number of, here we said at the beginning of the Perek that you need, at the beginning of the Masechta rather, in the first Perek, that you need a certain number of Dayanim to declare that it's a leap year, and you can't count Rishoyim like that towards that group. So even if that year needs to be a leap year because the tekufa is going to be too late, or because the Paris Ilan are not ripe or whatever, nevertheless, you can't have Rishoyim do that kind of thing. So that was Rish Lakish going back and forth on that, all in front of Rabbi Yochanan. Omer Rabbi Yochanan da oka. Rabbi Yochanan says to Rish Lakish, that's a problem. You're calling Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Shimon Rishoyim. Don't do that. He also lekameid Rabbi Yochanan. Eventually, when those two chachamim came back in front of Rabbi Yochanan, having declared their leap year, they heard what had happened. Omrulei, they said to Rabbi Yochanan, Korilan Roye Bakar v'le Omrulei Ma'ar v'le Midi. What's going on over here? Rish Lakish called us Roye Bakar. He compared us to cowherds, and you didn't say anything to him. Why don't you tell him that the same way as you told him Da Oka? This is a problem that you're calling two great Tamar chachamim Rishoyim. Why didn't you first protest when he called us Roye Bakar, when he compared us to cowards? Omalahu said, Rabbi Yochanan says, the Korilahu Roye Ksoin Maya Minalei, knew, and if he had called you shepherds, which are even more possible, because shepherds are also even more suspect of grazing their animals in other people's fields. So what could I have told him? The fact is, you kind of insulted him very, very, very badly. He came all the way with you, and you wouldn't even let him in, because you said he's a nudnik, so therefore, you know, I can't really hold that so much against him. Now, why don't they care about the fact that he called him Rishoyim? Why are they only caring about that he called him Roye Bakar? So first of all, Maor Shaw says maybe when they heard the report, they hadn't heard that whole part of the report. They heard the first part. Somebody had overheard him talking to Rabbi Yochanan and calling him Roye Bakar. They didn't hear the end of it. And also, they're saying, listen, as soon as he was saying the Roye Bakar, then you should have said something. Only at the end, when he called us Rishoyim, did you protest and say Da Oka. So Rabbi Yochanan is telling you that, you know what, you don't find, sometimes you find Tamar HaChachamim will use sharp expressions one about the other. In fact, you have that a similar kind of thing in Yevamos, the Gemara tells, where there's a discussion between the brother of Rabbi Yosef ben Hilkinas, Yonas ben Hilkinas, and Rabbi Akiva about a din. And the halachas of Yibum and Chalitza, and Rabbi Yonas, and this Yonason says to Rabbi Akiva that you know what, you're not even at the level of a Roye Bakar. And Rabbi Akiva answers, yeah, I agree, I'm not even at the level of Roye Tzoyed. So we see that sometimes Chachamim will talk like that, will talk sharply like that, and use insulting expressions like that to one another. So that's why I didn't protest when they said that. But when he said that about you, when he called you Rishoyim, then I agree that's going too far. Okay. My Kesher Rishoyim. Now, what does this mean? Rish Lakish used this expression, Kesher Rishoyim, a conspiracy of Rishoyim. Where do we know that? In fact, we don't follow that. Fine. I mean, the fact is, don't we say Achrid Abim Lahatis? We go according to the majority. Maybe it doesn't matter. The fact that they're Rishoyim, how can we just discount them? So the answer is like this: we have to go back to a story in the time of the first Beis Hamikdash. Now you have, there was King Chizkiah, and in his times you had the whole thing with Sancheirav invades Elu. Sancheirav had previously conquered the kingdom of the Aseret HaShvatim and taken them all into Golos. A few years later he's back to attack Eretz Yehuda. He starts attacking, he captures many of the fortified cities over there, then he advances on Yerushalayim, he has his huge army camped outside the walls of Yerushalayim over there, and eventually we're going to have in the last perek of Ar Masechta, we're going to talk about that whole story extensively, where eventually Hashem made a nest, and on the night of Pesach, pretty much that whole army was wiped out. Anyway, but during all of that, while everything was going on with that, with the siege, and with everything, so you have the psukim mention in that connection, a fellow named Shevna. Now you actually have, there's two different jobs that Shevna is mentioned as having held. In some places, it calls him Asher al-Haboyis, that he's in charge of the palace, meaning he's Chizkiyahu's chief of staff, a very important position in the government. In other places, it calls him Sofer. So does that mean it was the same person, and then he changed jobs, or does it mean... what Tosfos elsewhere discusses in Shas, whether maybe there were two people named Shevna. In any case, here we're focusing on one of them. So like this, Shevna have a Dorish B'Tleser Rav Vosa. Shevna, who was again, whether he was the chief of staff or the serf or whatever, he was one of Chizkiyahu's ministers. He was darshaning B'Tleser Rav Vosa. When he would darshan in Torah, he would have 13 times 10,000 people listening to his drasha. 130,000 people would be coming to hear Shevna's drashas in Torah, showing what a tremendous Talmud Chacham he was. Chizkiyah have a Dorish B'chadzar, Rabbi Vosser. Chizkiyah, meanwhile, only had an audience of 110,000. So Shevna has the greater following. He also Sancheirav Tzara Lodu Yerushalayim when Sancheirav came and besieged Yerushalayim, cost of Shevna Piska. Shevna wrote a note which he wanted to get out to Sancheirav, Shoda Begira, and he shot it with an arrow. The note said, Shevna v'siyayti hishlimu, Chizkiyah v'siyayti lo hishlimu. Shevna and his followers are willing to make peace. Chizkiyah and his followers are not willing to make peace. Now, the whole time, Sancheirav is sending people, he sent Rav Shakeh, his chief of staff, to give a whole long speech over there to try to convince the Jewish people to surrender. Don't trust in Chizkiyahu and his promises. Don't even trust that Hashem is going to save you, etc., etc. So this Shevna, who, as the Gemara is going to tell over here in the story, was a Rasha. So he sent a message to Sancheirav, basically throwing Chizkiyahu and his group under the bus and saying, you know what, here in Yerushalayim, there is actually a very large faction that's ready to surrender to you. But Chizkiyah and his group do not. And we know this, by the way, here in the Pesukim, it calls Shevna the Asher al-Aboyis in charge of the palace, or Sofer. The Medrash actually tells the story as well, along the same lines as in the Gemara over here, and it adds a couple of other opinions. There's an opinion that he was a Kohen Gadol. There's an opinion also that he was an Amalkal, one of the chief treasurers of the Beis Hamikdash. The Medrash also mentions an interesting point over there that he wasn't originally from Yerushalayim. He was originally from a place in the north of Eretz Yisrael called Sichnin. And then he moved to Yerushalayim and he went up in rank over there. Anyway, so Shenema, the Pasuk says, Kihine Rishoyim Yidushon Keshes. The Pasuk says, behold, the wicked people are stepping on the bow. Now a bow, you have to curve the bow as much as possible in order to make the arrow fly as far as possible. And so the way they would do it with the bows they had then is they would step on the bow in order to curve it, in order to get it to shoot as strongly as possible. So Yidruch and Keshes is a means, in other words, they're shooting the bow. Koino Chitzam al Yasser, they're placing their arrow on the bowstring to shoot it. And then the pasuk continues, Liros b'mo'ofel li'yishrelev, to shoot in the darkness against the ones who are upright heart. So in other words, here we have, the pasuk is describing the Ruach HaKodesh, how Shevna is going to be using an arrow to fight against the ones who are straight of heart, meaning Chizkiyah and his staffers, who are the good guys. And here Shevna is trying to use an arrow to betray them to Sancheirav. Havakam Miskafi Chizkiyah. Chizkiyah is afraid about it. Omar, he thinks to himself, you know what? They are, after all, the majority. Here Shevna has 103,000 Talmidim as compared to my 110,000. Dioma Chasvashalom, Nafti Adaita, Jakut Shabrichu, Basaruba. Maybe Hashem is going to follow the majority. Maybe, in fact, I should surrender. But Kivin de Ruba Mimsiri, once the majority want to surrender, Iunami Mimsiri, then we also should surrender ourselves. And then Sancheirav, in Rav Shaki's speech, he says, then Sancheirav will do the same to you
you as he did to the Aseres HaShevatim and to every other nation he conquered. He'll take you from here. He'll deport you to another land. But the Navi Yeshaya comes to Chizkiyah with a message. Don't call a kesher to whatever this people is calling a kesher. So in the simple sense, the word kesher in Tanakh often means a conspiracy. So in the simple meaning, it means something like you think that there's a conspiracy going on over here and you should join it. But you shouldn't. See, here we're explaining specifically it means Kesher Rishoyimu. This is a conspiracy of, this is a group of Rishoyim, Shevna, and all of his people. Shevna himself is a Rasha, and the people who are following him are either Rishoyim themselves, or at least are following a Rasha. The Kesher Rishoyim, Enam and Aminyan, the conspiracy, the gathering of Rishoyim is not considered a gathering. So in other words, the fact that they want to surrender, don't pay attention to them. No, Hashem is not on their side. Marshall explains, in other words, that because Hashem is not part of their minion, Hashem is part of yours, Hashem is on your side, not on theirs. So therefore, no matter how big their group is, nevertheless, and you see that Rav Shakeh is mocking Hashem, and they want to surrender to such a person. So no, Hashem is on your side. Don't worry about this kesher. Don't worry about the fact that they have this larger number of people than you. Well, the Gemara continues. So what was Shevna's end? Now previously, Holach Lachzad like Kever, the Kibbutz Beis David. Shevna had gone and carved himself out a grave among the graves of Beis David. He was very proud. He's a big Baal Gaiva. And he thought to himself, he's going to end up conspiring against Chizkiyah and get him and get him deposed and himself become a king like this. Sancheirib had come to begin with to attack because Chizkiyah had rebelled against him. He wasn't paying the taxes, whatever. So now Shevna figures, you know what? Then what I'll do is I'll surrender to Sancheirib. We'll have a coup over here. We'll overthrow Chizkiyah. I'll become the new king and then I'll surrender to Sancheirib and we'll be able to stay safely over here. And eventually I'll be buried over here among Malchi Beis David. So he went to carve himself out a grave over there. Bon Navi V'Amaloi, the king, the Navi Yeshaya, comes to Shevna and says to him a very sharp nevuah that you find in Sefer Yeshaya, Malacha Poi or Milacha Poi, what is it to you and who do you have over here? In other words, is there anybody even from your family buried over here? Like that Medrash says, he comes from Sichni in the north of Eretz Yisrael. What are you doing here in your Yerushalayim in the first place? And what makes you think you have any right to a caver over here? Tichot Savta Lacha Poi Kover. That you've carved out for yourself, that you've hewn out for yourself a grave over here. Very interestingly, by the way, actually, they found in archaeological digs in Yerushalayim, they found an ancient grave that seems to be from that time, and it has an inscription on it that says that it belongs to somebody Yahu Asher Alaboy. The first half of the name is missing. You have the letters Yud and He and Vov from the end of the name, Asher Alaboy, which was, as we said in the politics, that was Shevna's position. So there is quite a bit of discussion. There's an interesting idea that the archaeologists have said, maybe this is the very grave that we're talking about over here, and the name was actually Shvanyahu. Shevna then would be a short version of the name, the same way as Ezra, for example, is a short version of Azaryahu. So it would mean that originally the name Shvanyahu, meaning Shevna, was written on there and then somebody hacked it off. So maybe that was the caver very caver is the one that they found that he built over here, and Yeshaya is telling them off for it. Anyway, then Hashem continues, the Novi continues in Hashem's name. Hine Hashem metaltelcha. Behold, Hashem is going to make you have to move. Hashem is going to kick you out of your shalim, and you're going to go wandering. Taltela gover, the wandering of a man. So the Gemara interjects. What does that mean? Why of a man? Amarav tiltula de gavra koshimi de itza. When a man has to go wandering, is worse than it is for a woman. Different Mephoshim talk about why that should be. On the Pasuk over there, that Radak explains that, listen, a woman is usually more helpless, so people usually have more rachmonis on her as opposed to a man, not so much. Very interesting thing, the Meshech Chochma says, the reason is it has to do with the dinim of tzaras. The Gemara is going to explain soon. The Gemara is going to explain on the next line that Shevna got tzaras. Now, the din is when a man has tzaras, he has to do certain things to show it publicly. He has to let his hair grow long and tear his clothing, whereas a woman does not. And then he says that here that we're going to have in the continuation of the story over here. So therefore, in that sense, his tiltor, when he's going to be thrown out of Yerushalayim because he has tzaras, then he's going to be worse off than he would have been if he had been a woman, because he has to go around with long hair and torn clothing. Anyway, so, uh, so, uh, So in short, the Navi is telling him you're going to be thrown out of here, and you, instead of having a grave over here that you thought you're going to live out your whole life over here, and you're going to be buried here after 120, no, you're going to be kicked out, and you're going to be going wandering, and you're going to have the worst kind of wandering. The pasuk continues, Yeshaya tells him, v'oitcha oto, and Hashem is going to be oitcha oto. In the simple sense of oitcha means he'll wrap you up, like when you wrap something out to throw it out. But the Gemara is understanding, this teaches us that Shevna was struck with tzaras. How do we know that? One of the things he has to do, he has to take the edge of his talus or similar garment that he's wearing and cover his face with it down to his lip. And the pasuk uses the word for it, while safam yata, he has to cover himself on the lips. So we see the word yata is similar to the word va'oitcha oto over here, same shodash, so it means that Shevna got tzaras. Then Yeshaya continues in the next pasuk, tsonoif yitznofcha tznefa, Hashem will wrap you up, tsonoif is like a mitznefes, like you wrap the strip over and over again to make a turban, so tsonoif yitznofcha tznefa is the same shodash three times, meaning that Hashem is gonna wrap you up and then like so to speak bandage you up, kadur, like a row of soldiers. You're going to be surrounded. In other words, it actually translates, you're going to be surrounded and encompassed by soldiers. Kadur, dur means a row, so rows and rows of soldiers. El eretz rachvas yadayim begomer, and you're going to be taken in golos to a wide land, and there you're going to die over there. Tosfos actually brings a different explanation of the word. A couple of other explanations of the word kadur. Kadur can mean like a ger who has no permanent place. In that case, it would be Meloshin Dira. Another explanation is kadur means a ball. So it means you're going to have like a ball that gets thrown and kicked around is how you're going to wind up in Golos. And the Navi tells him, this is all that's going to happen, that there, the Navi continues, that the words in the Pasuk, the Shama Marka, this is not quoted in the Gemara over here, but you can find that in the Pasuk, that the Navi tells him, the Shama Marka was Kvoidecha, there are going to be the chariots of your glory, Kvoid based, Kloin based Adinecha, the embarrassment of your master's house. In other words, the Navi is telling him, here you thought to have greatness and importance and chariots over there and to humble and you thought you were going to humble and embarrass your master, Chizkiah, by surrendering and then taking over his kingship, and no, it's going to be the other way around. You're the one who's going to end up in trouble. Tana, we learn in a brisa. Who bikish coin base Adonav? He tried to embarrass and shame the house of his master by telling Sancheidev that we're ready to surrender and I'll work to depose Chizkiah and become king instead of him. And therefore, instead of fichach nefach kvoda l'kolon, therefore his glory, that he was such an important minister, instead turned into shame, and he himself was thrown out of Yerushalayim and punished severely, as the Gemara is going to go on to tell. So what happened? Kiyav nofik ihu, when Shevna, with his group, is ready to go out to actually surrender to Sancheiriv, also Gavriel achdil adosha ba'afi mashir yisei. Gavriel came and closed the door in front of his group. So now he's outside the wall by himself. He was expecting that the rest of his entourage, the whole 130,000 with him, are going to come and hear nothing. And he had already made it clear in his message to Sancheiriv that he has a whole following. In fact, the Meshech Chochma says this may explain one reason why he left Yerushalayim. It wasn't only in order to surrender to Sancheiriv. We said he got tzaras. So a person with tzaras has to be thrown, has to be sent out of the city. So they asked him, Sancheiriv's soldiers asked him, Mashir Yisrecheicha, where's your whole entourage, where's your whole army that you said you're bringing out? Omri says, Hodrubi, they realizes they're not there, they must have changed their mind and left me. So the Sancheiriv's people say, Kain, well then you're making fun of us. you made a whole joke out of it. You're claiming that you have a whole following over here in Yerushalayim who are ready to surrender. And here it turns out it's only you. And the Meshech Chochma adds that point. In other words, they're saying also, look at that. It's obvious that you left only because you have tzaras, not because you really had a whole following. So they punished him. They made holes in his heels. And they They tied him to the tails of their horses, and they're dragging him around on the thorns and the thistles. So that was his punishment. That was the, when we say that, Malkavos Kodecha, you expected you're going to have your chariots of honor, and instead you have these chariots are being used to drag you around and humiliate you. Maharsha goes through some of the details that we had over here. In particular, that's also why it's being compared to a ball, you kick a ball, and it goes and rolls around by itself all over the ground. And if it's flat ground, Eretz Rachvas Yadayim, then it goes as far as possible, the same way you're going to be dragged around in a very wide area. Okay, so the point is, the reason why we brought this in, again, was to show this point of Kesher Rishoyim, that even though Shevna did have that very large following, nevertheless, Hashem told you, Chizkiah, through the Navi Yeshaya, don't worry about it, they're Kesher Rishoyim, and they don't count. Okay, continuing a little bit more on the topic of Shevna, Amar Rav Elazar, Shevna Baal Hanah Hoya. Shevna was a Baal Hanah. Rashi gives two explanations on it. One is that it just means exactly that he was into his Hanah, he's into his physical typhus. Then Rashi gives another explanation, he was into Mishkav Zohar. Either way, the point is, in other words, even though on the surface he seemed to be a great Talmid Chacham, either way he had this underlying bad midas, and eventually it came out in public. Where do we see that? Ksiv Hocha, Lech Boya La Soichin Hazeh. Here, when Hashem tells Yeshaya to go to Shevna and give him that harsh nevuah about that caver that he had made for himself and about what his ultimate fate is going to be, Hashem tells Yeshaya, go to the Soichin. Now, the simple meaning of Soichin means like a minister or something. But Uchtiv Hosem, by David, we have Oshilo Seichenes. In the previous parak, we had about Avishag Ashunamis, who was supposed to help warm David's body up, and it uses the expression that she will be a Seichenes to him. So we see, in other words, that Seichen and Seichenes have to do with people lying together. So again, either it means that he's into his physical tivus in general, or specifically into Mishkav Zohar. V'oimer, we have another pasuk. Now, the Gemara had quoted the pasuk before. So the Gemara had quoted the pasuk before. Kihine Rishoyim Yidruchun Keshes. We said the Rishoyim step on the bow and they're trying to shoot an arrow against the Yishrei Lev, and we said that refers to the story of Shevna. So now the Gemara continues by darshan in the next pasuk in that Tepitzel Tillim. The pasuk continues. Kiyah Shoses Yehareisun. When the Shoses are destroyed, Tzadik Mapal. What has the Tzadik accomplished? So the simple meaning is. A simple meaning is it's talking about, for example, after Noiv Irakonim was wiped out, then he's saying the foundation of the world, the tzaddikim, have been destroyed. So therefore, David is saying, Tzadik Mapal, what did I, the Tzadik, do wrong, even though it had a certain connection with David, as we're going to learn in the last parak of the Masech, and nevertheless, David is disclaiming any responsibility for it, because ultimately it was Doeg HaDoni who did it. But the Gemara here darshins, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Eina, Chad Omar, one says, both of them say that this is referring to the story, but one says, Ilu Chizkiah v'siyatin harosim, if Chizkiah and his group were to have been destroyed, if Shevna had gotten his way, and they would have been killed and then overthrown, Tzadik Mapal, then what would Hashem, the Tzadik, have accomplished? In other words, how could we say? What kind of payment, what kind of reward would Hashem have given the Tzadikim? Like this Chizkiah and his group deserve a reward from Hashem for their faithfulness to the Torah. So if Shevna had gotten his way, then what kind of reward would Hashem have been giving them? In other words, the implication is David is saying, Hashem, don't allow Shevna and company to be successful, because then that wouldn't be fair to Chizkiah and company. But Ullah explains it differently. According to that, the word Shoses refers to the Tzaddikim, as the Gemara is going to explain in a second. Ullah darshins the pasuk as follows. Ilu machshavosav shal oisei rosha, einan neherosis. It means if the thoughts and the ideas and plans of that Rosha Shevna are not destroyed, Tzadik Mapal, what would Tzadik refers to Chizkiah, the Tzadik, what would he have accomplished? In other words, where would be the appropriate reward? Where would be the appropriate reward for his tzidkus, for the good things that he did? So in the first explanation, then we're saying Ki Ashoses Yehareisun, that if the tzaddikim are destroyed, Tzadik Mapal, then what would Hashem the Tzadik have accomplished for Chizkiah? And the other explanation is the other way around. Ki Ashoses Yehareisun, if the thoughts of the Rosha, the one who's getting ready to draw and to draw his bow and shoot the arrow, if those plans don't get destroyed, the word shoses, that would mean his machshavas, that yehiresim, they deserve to be destroyed, because otherwise, tzadik mapal, otherwise, how would Chizkiah get the reward for all the good things he did? So that's Rabbi Hordan and Rabbi Ena. Wait, did I skip? Yes, I think I skipped a couple of lines over here, sorry. One understands the word chosis to be referring to Chizkiah. The second one, between Rabbi Hordan and Rabbi Ena, understands the word chosis to refer to the Beis Mikdash. If the Beis Mikdash were to be destroyed because of Shevna's machinations, Tzadik Mapal, then where would we see the accomplishments of the Tzadik Hashem because after all, how could it be that such a thing would happen? But Ula Omar and Ula says, the third explanation, it means if the thoughts of that Rosha, Shevna, are not cancelled out and not destroyed, Tzadik Mapal, then how would Chizkiah Tzadik get the reward for that he deserves for his mice and turban? So the Gemara says, let's go through the three explanations. We understand, according to the opinion, that Shoses means the thoughts of the Rosha Shevna. Then we can understand, the Pasuk is saying that the Shoses, the thoughts, deserve to be destroyed. And the word shoses can refer to thoughts that actually mentions, for example, you have the expression in the pasuk for the shos liba gam lozois, that parrot didn't pay attention to makas dam, so we see that the word shoses has to do with thoughts. And according to the explanation that the shoses refers to the Beis Mikdash, and it's saying that if the Beis Mikdash were to be destroyed, nami, then we can say also the Tanan. We learn in a Mishnah that we see that the word shoses has to do with the Beis Mikdash. The Tanan, as we have the Mishnah in Yuma, Evan Hoysa Shami Mos Nevi'im Rishonim, there was a stone in the Kodesh of Kedoshim since the times of the Uli Nevi'im, of David and Shloima, or Shsia Hoysa Nikris, it was called the Evan Shsia. So Shsia, same Shodesh as shoses. And in fact, it actually brings from the Gemara there in Yuma, that's what the whole world was founded from. It was the first thing that Hashem created, and then everything else in the world unfolded from that. But if you say that Shoses refers to Chizkiah and his group, where do we find Tzaddikim called Shoses? And the answer is yes, we do. To Hashem belong the foundations of the world. And Hashem placed and supported the world with them. That the tzaddik upholds the world. So therefore, yes, we can see therefore that the tzaddikim are called shoses. The boisem mahacha. Or you have another pasuk. Hifli etsa hidil tushia. The pasuk says Hashem has brought forth amazing advice, amazing counsel, and great tushia. Tushia, as the Gemara is going to explain, refers to the Torah, and that's also from the same Shodesh as Shosos. So therefore, what it means is that, yes, it means that the Tzaddikim uphold, the Tzaddikim are the foundation that hold up the world, because they learn Torah, which is called Tushia, as the Gemara is going to go on to say over here. So therefore, yes, the Tzaddikim can be called Shosos. All three explanations will work with the wording of the Pasuk. So let's talk about Tushia meaning Torah. Why indeed is Torah called Tushia? Because it weakens a person's koyach. So you have, there's the idea, you have, for example, in the famous story of Rish Lakish, that once he accepted on himself to learn Torah, then he couldn't even jump across the river anymore. You have, in general, there's the idea, the Zohar has an expression, "Tuk for the neshmasa chosha de gufa." When the neshama is stronger, the body is weaker. So therefore, Torah, which strengthens a person's neshama, causes his body to be weaker. It also includes that it weakens his taiva for dvarim gashniim. It means it weakens his koyach, specifically the idea that he's going to think to himself, koichi va'otzim yadi, that my power is what's making things happen for me. So whatever, the point is that the Torah has that effect. So Tushia, Meloshin Makteshes, it weakens. Dabaracha, another explanation, Tushia, Shinitza Machashayim Pnei HaSatan. Another reason Torah is called Tushia is because it was given in secret because of the Satan. I mean, the Satan was going to be Makatrig and say that the Torah should stay up in Shemayim. It shouldn't be given to Moshe. So therefore, Hashem did it in secret. In what way? What do you mean in secret? The Torah was given with Kolos of Rokim and all that fanfare. So, uh, so, So Tosfos elsewhere explains, actually Tosfos in Shabbos, in the Sugya, but Matan Torah explains that Hashem, so to speak, distracted the Sukkim and kept him busy with other things so that he can't be Makatrig. So therefore, therefore that's what we mean. Nitna Bahashai, that was done in a way to hide it from the Sukkim. Then in addition, there's another explanation that the Gemara is referring over here primarily to the second luchos, which were in fact given without any of that fanfare. So that's another reason why the Torah is called Tushia. So to see a Moloshin Chashai, Moloshin secret. Dover Acha, another explanation why the Torah is called Toshia. Dover Acha, Toshia, Dvorim Shal Toihu Shal Olam Meshutas Aleihem. There's things that seem to be meaningless. They seem to be just words. They seem to be just insubstantial words. But the whole, words of Torah, I mean, after all, they're just words seemingly. But Shal Olam Meshutas Aleihem, but the whole world is founded and stands on Torah. So that's another reason. Tushia is toihu meshusas. That's it. It seems to be vanity. It seems to be emptiness. It's not something practical, and yet the whole world is founded on and stands on Torah. Okay. The Gemara continues. Oma ola machshava me'ela safilu l'divrei Torah. When a person has thoughts, for example, of what he's going to do about panosa or whatever, that has an effect and causes him to forget his learning, even divrei Torah. Here we're going to have another drasha with the word tushia, but in other words, the point is, machshava, a person has these thoughts that makes him worry about what he's going to do, about panosa, whatever, that causes him to forget, and causes him to forget Torah. Tosfos explains a little differently, that it means it causes him to forget everything else, but including also divrei Torah. Tosfos also brings another explanation. Me'elas can be meloshin mo'al, as in meloshin me'ila, like to lie. It's not going to be successful. A person is thinking to himself to become rich, and he's going to be zoicha to divrei Torah. It's not going to work. Generally speaking, a person, as the Gemara sometimes says in some places, a person is not usually zoicha to shnei shulchanos. A person is not usually zoicha to physical wealth, to material wealth, as well as wealth in Torah. It can happen, but it's not common, and therefore me'elas it usually betrays him that way of thinking. There are places, by the way, where the Rebbeim used machshava me'elas in a more positive way, that machshava, a thought, for example, the Friedrich Rebbe opens the Hutta Diburim by saying that machshava me'elas, a thought about, for example, about a chosid who was stuck in Russia, and then the Eibishta helped him get out of there, me'elas, that thought that the Friedrich Rebbe had on him, was me'elas, it was effective to get him out of that matzav. But here the Gemara is using it in a different sense. Anyway, Shenema, as the Pasuk says, mefer machshavos arumim, Hashem cancels out the plots of the plans of the arumim, of the sharp ones, of the crafty ones. V'loy saseni yedeim tushia, and their hands will not produce tushia. So in other words, we're darshaning as follows. The arumim means, in other words, you have the, So Rashi gives two explanations. First is that because they were arumim in the sense of naked, they didn't have anything, and therefore they were worried about what's going to happen. Instead, Hashem takes away those thoughts from their hearts, so that now, because until now, that was preventing them from Tushia, from learning Torah, and now Hashem takes that away so that they're able to participate in Torah. The second explanation, now she says the other way around, is the person is going to think to himself that I'm going to accomplish such and such, and therefore that makes it that he doesn't necessarily accomplish it even by divrei Torah. So a person, for example, says, I'm going to learn such and such by a certain time, sometimes Hashem causes that those plans fall through because like, he's being too certain about himself. He should at least say the Ezras Hashem or something like that. And therefore we're saying, Mefer Machshavos Arumim, that his thoughts don't, as planned, don't end up working out, even for Divrei Torah. Even he says, for example, I'm setting myself a goal. I'm going to learn X amount by such and such a time. But he doesn't say that he's relying on Hashem for that. Then Hashem causes him to forget that and not to be able to accomplish it. However, Rabbah says, if he's learning Torah l'shma, then it's not me'elas, then it's not effective or disloyal or whatever, meaning then it does actually work. Shenema, as you have the pasuk, Rabbah's machshavos belevish, there are many thoughts in the heart, and there are many thoughts in the heart of a person. V'atzas Hashem hisokum, the advice, the counsel of Hashem is what will stand, meaning Eitzah sheyesh b'dvar Hashem, when he has advice and counsel that has in it the word of Hashem, meaning when he's learning l'shma, hisokum lo'olam, then it will last forever. So here, in other words, we're saying, so according to Rashi, the first explanation is, so according to Rashi, the point would be that he thought that he's going to accomplish a certain amount of learning in a certain amount of time. If he's doing it with Shema, or for that matter, the same thing with his business, then Hashem will make him be successful. According to Tosfos, the verdict is that here, such a thought would be disloyal and would end up betraying him. It's not necessarily going to work, but if he's doing it with Shema, then it will work. Okay. Getting back now to matters of who's kosher and posel leeders. So the Mishnah had said as follows. The Mishnah had listed a number of people who are kosher leeders or posel leeders. One of them was a gambler, and the Gemara discussed why exactly gamblers are posel. And so then the Mishnah had continued. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Emesai, Rabbi Yehuda had said, when does that apply? When this is their only business. But when they do other things as well, when he says, Yeshlan umnas shaloihu, when they have a different kind of business, then they're kosher, says Rabbi Yehuda. Now the Gemara had pointed out on Chafdal and Amar Beis, there were two reasons why gambling makes a person postulatus. Rami Bachoma had given a reason, because when he takes the money, it's a matter of asmachta. The other person didn't sincerely mean to give it up. He was expecting to win. He was expecting to be a sharper player or whatever, and therefore when he gives it away, he's not fully intending to, and therefore it's a kind of gezel. And Rav Sheshes had said the reason is because ein asukin yeshuva shaloyim, because they're not doing anything useful for the world. Because gambling is not something that advances human society in any way. The Rambam summarizes that the person really ought to be. Either he's learning Torah, or he's having a job and doing something useful for the world. Gambling is neither of the above. So now, when we say so Rabbi Yehuda's Amosai fits better with Rav Sheshes' explanation. In fact, the Gemara says over there, according to Rami Bachama, Rabbi Yehuda would actually be arguing with the Chachamim and saying that's not because it's not because of Asnachta, it's rather because of a different reason. But anyway, so the halacha Rabbi Yehuda, the halacha is indeed like Rabbi Yehuda, that as long as this gambler has some other means of support, of work, where he's doing some other kind of useful work, then in fact he's not posel leiders. Because the only reason he's posel leiders in the first place is because he's not doing anything useful for society. And in this case, if he has an actual job, then he is doing something useful for society, and therefore he can be kosher leiders. Still doesn't mean, by the way, that gambling is mutter in halacha. The fact is, we did have Rami Bachama's point about, and the Gemara had also mentioned, and the Mishnah had also mentioned something called Mafriche Yonim, which is also, the Gemara had given an explanation that it was a type of gambling. So in short, in other words, it's one thing Post can talk about. It's one thing, for example, with his own family. Let's say, for example, you're playing dreidel or something, and you're gambling in effect for pennies or for winkies or whatever. It's one thing, but not necessarily gambling. Not necessarily gambling with other people wouldn't necessarily be allowed up here halacha. But we're saying it doesn't necessarily make him posulators. Well, the Gemara continues. All of the ones mentioned in the Mishnah, they're not automatically posel. They need to be announced about in Beis Din that they're posel leeders, and otherwise they're not. Otherwise they're not posel. So the Gemara continues. Roya, now what about when it comes to a shepherd, where the Mishnah had said he's possible because often shepherds graze their animals in other people's fields? Pligi Barav Acha Ravina. So Rav Acha and Ravina argue about that one. Chadam Aboyach Roza, one of them says him also you need to announce about before he becomes possible later. V'chadam Aloy Boyach Roza. The other one says you don't need, because when he does something that's very blatantly obvious. The other ones, the gambler and the one who's selling payers Shavius or whatever, it's not so obvious that what they're doing is wrong. But here, it's very obvious he's going into other people's fields and grazing his animals over there. So therefore, so one opinion says you don't need to announce that. Well, the Gemara says, "Bishleim l'manda amalad boyach roza." Well, I understand according to the opinion that he doesn't need to be announced that he's automatically posel. Hainu do amar of Yehuda amar Rav stam roya posel. Well, that explains previously on Chafdal and Amar Beis, Rabbi Yehuda had said in the name of Rav that by default a shepherd is posel. Because that's the thing. As long as he's a shepherd and he grazes his animals in other people's fields, then he's automatically posel. Ella lamanda oma boyach roza. But if you say he first needs to be announced about, my stam roya posel, what do you mean by default a roya is posel? He's not by default posel because they didn't announce. And the answer is, what it means is debisama machajin in alay. What it means is that even if we don't know that this particular shepherd is doing this, we can announce that he's acting as a shepherd and he's grazing animals in Eretz Yisrael or in places near people's fields, and therefore he's posel. So in other words, we're going to assume that as a roya he's posel, unless we know otherwise. But they still do need that announcement. So the Gemara gives an example. Ahi matona, there was a shtai matona. Dav chasim alei trein gazlonim. Two gazlonim were signed on it. So, as the agent. Sovra rapapa bashmol, achshura. So rapapa bashmol thought to say it's kosher. The whole ach was in an alayo because we didn't announce about them. Amalei Rava, but Rava says to Rapapa, no. Nihid but in an achroza. True, we need to be announced. That would be the gazlon dirabbanon. That would be when the gzela is only something dirabbanon. For example, the ones in our Mishnah where, So the ones in the Mishnah had been, for example, where he's gambling, where again it's a type of gezel because of asnachta, or malva beribis, actually was not gazel, was not gzela, but they were talking about he's lending at ribis derabanan, or mafriche yonim. The Gemara had given two explanations of what mafriche yonim is. One that it's people who lure other people's pigeons away, but we're talking about the pigeons themselves are feral, so they're not actually completely domesticated, so it's not real gezel. Or the other explanation is it was a type of gambling, it's like they're betting on pigeon races. So all of those are gazlanim derabanan. So those kind you need to announce. The gazlan deraisa maybe in an achrosa, but when it comes to a gazlan deraisa, do we need to announce? No. So therefore, these guys are gazlonim deraisa. They literally grabbed something out of people's hands. Therefore, Rava is saying that. Therefore, Rava is saying you don't need to announce on them. Even without an announcement, we're going to say they're posoladus. Okay. So then the Gemara will continue, and we'll continue tomorrow, Beth Hashem, with various other cases of people who do averus. When are they posoladus and when not?